So first of all, Annette, thank you so much. This was I couldn't wish for a better presentation and introduction. And I want to thank not only Annette Henninger, but also Johanna Hell, who has been a wonderful host and the Center for Gender Studies and Feminist Research here at the University of Marburg, for inviting me. It's my first time in Marburg, and I hope I will also have a little bit of time to visit the town that looks really beautiful from what I've seen so far. So as Annette already said in the introduction, today I will be really speaking mostly about this book, which was published 2 years ago. And in many ways, I feel like saying, unfortunately, the things I've written are still very relevant today, and I fear they will be even more relevant in the future. And I say unfortunately because obviously what I am describing and criticizing is a very in a way scary scenario, although maybe I will try to be more cheerful towards the end and say how we can also maybe better things in a way. So anyway, I thought that I want to begin by telling you a little bit about what prompted me to write this book. So in 2011, I was living in Germany, in fact, in Constance, and with some colleagues, I organized a conference on the mobilization of feminist ideas by the right wing. Jasbir Puar's book on homo nationalism, which you might have heard about, had been published just a few years earlier and had opened up a wide and important conversation on what she called the collusions between the gay and LGBTQ movement in the United States and American nationalism and Islamophobia. In Europe, a number of political analysts, feminist scholars and sociologists were wondering, how is that far right-wing parties are trying to convince us that they care about women's rights and that they want to fight Islam in order to defend those rights? So how is it possible that these parties that are, as we all know, traditionally anti-feminist are instead presenting themselves as parties that care about women? So here I have just a few slides to show you very briefly some examples of how these parties have done that. So this is a slide, this is an example of a poster from the Northern League, which is, as you might know, a far right wing party in Italy, currently in the government. The current leader of the Northern League is the vice prime minister at the moment. And this is an older poster, though, it's from around 2006, when there were discussions all across Europe about the possible entrance of Turkey into the European Union. And on that occasion, this is the type of poster that the Northern League came up with, which the message is very, very clear. So if you allow Turkey to enter Europe, we will end up with women in cages and veiled rather than with professional free women and so forth. So the instrumentalization of women's rights is very clear. The second image statement is actually more recent. It's from Marine Le Pen in 2016, the leader of the now is the National Rally, the National Assembly, I guess is translated into English. And this is what she said when she was the leader of the Front National in 2016. I'm scared that the migrant crisis signals the beginning of the end of women's rights, by which she meant, I'm scared that all these migrants coming into Europe will mean that we won't have women's rights anymore. So again, she's making this link between migrants and the end of women's rights. The last example I'll give you for now is this one again from Italy. This was a poster very, very used throughout social networks and the media just a couple of years ago again. And it shows, obviously you can see this Italian woman, she married Ahmed, clearly an Arabic Muslim sounding name, and that's why she was beaten, obviously. So again, the connection is, if you marry someone from a Muslim man, that's what happens to you. He will abuse of you and he will exercise violence against you. So this was used, sorry, I didn't say the source. This was, again, used by a coalition of right-wing parties in Italy, including the Northern League, in a website that is explicitly devoted to list all the crimes by migrants. And when you look at the crimes that they collect in this website, I would say that 60-65% of them have to do with sexual assault, rape, and so forth. So there is a very clear intention of presenting migrant men, Muslim men, but not only Muslim men, be careful, migrant men more generally, as sexual predators, as a threat for women. So obviously these are quite disturbing images. And as someone who had worked for several years on issues of female migration, and especially stereotypes and representations of migrant and Muslim women in Europe, I was very interested in all these questions. I wanted to understand how is it that these parties are now presenting themselves as defenders of women's rights. And I was especially interested in understanding the so-called rescue narratives, as have been named. So how is that they present themselves as those who want to rescue women? And also, how is that also not only right-wingers, but some feminists and also neoliberals, as I will explain, are also addressing Muslim and migrant communities and claiming that women need to be emancipated from their backward cultures, Muslim women and migrant women. So I started to really work on this topic more closely. As I said, I had been working, actually, even before working on the thesis on Max Weber, throughout my work, I've really paid lots of attention to migrant women. I did lots of work in Italy, female migration and the care labor in Italy, but also in other European countries. So I was particularly interested in understanding this representation of Muslim women and migrant women by the right wing, but I was not entirely happy with the studies that had been carried out so far. And the reason I wasn't too happy was not because they were not good studies. There are excellent studies out there about these issues, and many of them have called this phenomena sexual nationalism. If you look at the work of Eric Fassin, for example, in France, or other authors who talk about sexual nationalism, or, as I said, Jasbir Puar talks of homonationalism in the case of the instrumentalization of gay rights. But my feeling was that all these studies somehow were focusing, I don't want to say too much, but perhaps in a way almost exclusively on the cultural aspects, on the political aspects. And they were also emphasizing almost exclusively, I would say, what happened in the aftermaths of 9/11, that, as you probably can imagine already, has been quite important as an event to frame all these discussions about Islam and women's rights. So also, my background also as a Marxist and social reproduction feminist was actually to look into the political economic perspective as well. So I started to try to connect these elements and try to understand if we could in fact find the economic foundations of these femo-nationalist phenomenon. And that's how actually this book began. So in the time that I have left, I really want to go to the core of one of the central topics, at least, of this book. So just briefly, this book analyzes what I call the convergence on anti-Islam politics among three very different political agendas: right-wing nationalists, some feminists and femocrats, and neoliberal policies. I analyze this convergence in three countries that have shown important similarities in the ways in which this convergence has taken place: France, Netherlands, and Italy. So from Geert Wilders in the Netherlands to Marine Le Pen in France and Matteo Salvini in Italy, as I've shown you at the beginning, one of the central tropes mobilized by these right-wing nationalists is the profound danger Muslim males constitute for Western European societies, due above all to their oppressive treatment of women. On the other side of the political spectrum, some well-known and outspoken feminists have also joined the anti-Islam choir. So throughout the 2000s, internationally renowned French feminist philosopher Elisabeth Badinter, Dutch feminist politician Ayaan Hirsi Ali, and the famous Italian occasional feminist Oriana Fallaci have denounced Muslim communities as exceptionally sexist, contrasting them to Western countries as sites of superior gender relations. I guess a local example, a German example here, is probably Alice Schwarzer. Similarly, women's organizations, as well as top-ranking bureaucrats in state gender equality agency, they are often termed femocrats, they all singled out Islamic religious practices as especially patriarchal, arguing that they had no place in the Western public sphere. Accordingly, they have all endorsed legal proposals such as veil bans, while portraying Muslim women as passive victims who need to be rescued and emancipated. This heterogeneous anti-Islam feminist front thus presents sexism and patriarchy as the almost exclusive domain of the Muslim other. And one example I give usually here is that of Elisabeth Badinter, who is a very famous feminist philosopher. And I just read it because I think it's easier if I do it, otherwise you will be distracted while I speak. So she writes, in this possibility, she writes this about the full veil, the burqa of women, because she was asked by the French state, by the government in 2010, what she thought about the possibility of banning the burqa from public spaces. And this is what she says. In this possibility of being looked at without being seen, and to look at the other without him, her being able to see you, I see the satisfaction of a triple perverse enjoyment. The enjoyment of one's supremacy over the other, the enjoyment of the exhibitionist, and the enjoyment of the voyeur. I think we are dealing with very sick women, and I do not think we have to be determined according to their pathology. So she very clearly says these Muslim women who wear the full veil are pathological, they are sick. There is something wrong with them, psychologically speaking. So quite strong statement. So the peculiar encounter between anti-Islam agendas and the emancipatory rhetoric of women's rights is not, however, restricted to nationalists and feminists. Neoliberal advocates, who are otherwise anti-nationalist, or so they claim, have also increasingly deployed anti-Islam representations in the name of women's rights. And a good example of these are the so-called civic integration programs for migrants, which are, as I will explain a little bit better later, they are a landmark of neoliberalism. So I think you have a version of these civic integration programs also here in Germany. They are basically the programs that many European states are using to assess the integration of migrants. So the way it works usually is that, obviously, there are differences among countries, but usually the idea is that when a migrant comes to Europe, they need to pass a test. For example, they need to demonstrate that they can speak the language of the country, that they know the history of the country, they know the values of the country. And this is done in different ways in different countries. But the core idea is the same. And the idea is precisely that their integration or their willingness to be integrated needs to be certified if for their visa to be renewed. So there are very practical consequences for these civic integration programs. So these integration programs, this is what I actually want to focus on, it's quite interesting that they increasingly focus on women's rights. So I will give you again just a little example. This is actually the page of a booklet that was given in France until a few years ago. They are not using this anymore, they're using other tools now. But when I was carrying out my research, this is what was one of the tools that was used. So to make it this very clear, what happens is that migrants enter France, for example, they are called to this office, which is an office specialized on these integration issues. And when they go to this office, first they are shown a video about life in France, and then they're also given this booklet. And both the video and the booklet say, oh, for example, in France, laïcité, secularism is very important. We truly believe in the separation between the church, religion, and the state. But they also increasingly say women's rights in France are very important. And if you look at these materials, you can see that the issue of secularism, which has always been a French obsession in many ways that we can discuss later perhaps, and the issue of women's rights are becoming increasingly, they are very much intertwined and they are very strong. Now, obviously, there is nothing wrong in telling migrants or anyone, in fact, that women's rights are important. Don't get me wrong about this. What is interesting and I think problematic is the way in which women's rights are presented to these to these migrants, because they are presented in a way that somehow assume that these migrants do not know anything about women's rights. So the assumption is that these migrants are kind of savages who need to learn from Europeans and from French how to respect women. So there is a very strong assumption behind these materials, and I will tell you more about this also later. So in light of this, the question that I explore in my, the questions that I explore in my book are, why are these very different movements, right? So as I said, right-wing parties, nationalists and some feminists, why are they invoking the same trope and identifying Muslim men as one of the most dangerous threats to Western societies? Are we witnessing the rise of a new unholy alliance, or is this a seeming consensus across the political spectrum merely coincidental and contingent? And finally, why are Muslim women being presented with offers of emancipation and rescue in a context of rising Islamophobia and anti-immigration sentiments, particularly regarding employment and welfare? So in order to answer these questions and to frame the political economic logic underpinning this unexpected convergence among these very different political agendas, I have coined this term femonationalism. Femonationalism is short for feminist and femocratic nationalism. It refers both to the exploitation of feminist themes by nationalists and neoliberals in anti-Islam, but as I will show also anti-immigration campaigns, and to the participation of certain feminists and femocrats in the stigmatization of Muslim men under the banner of gender equality. Femonationalism thus describes, on the one hand, the attempts of Western European right-wing parties and neoliberals to advance xenophobic and racist politics through the touting of gender equality, while on the other hand, it captures the involvement of various well-known and quite visible feminists and femocrats in the current framing of Islam as a quintessentially misogynistic religion and culture. So, in this presentation, I want to suggest that femonationalism must be understood as an ideology that springs from a specific mode of encounter, or as I prefer to say, a convergence, amongst different political projects, and that is produced by and productive of a specifically economic logic. So the next part of this paper is devoted to clarifying one key dimension of femonationalism, which is femonationalism as neoliberal political economy. I'm not going into details about why I talk about this as a convergence. Maybe there are questions about this, which obviously I will be happy to answer. So I want to focus why I talk about this as a neoliberal political economy. So, as I said at the outset, there are very few studies that have tried to explore the political economic foundations of these ideological convergences. So, these few studies have attempted to take into account, sorry, the very few studies that have tried to take into account the political economic dimensions of these phenomena, in my view, have they have all said neoliberalism is important to understand why now these nationalist formations are saying that they defend women's rights or that they defend gay rights. But they have done in this, in my view, in a way that doesn't really interrogate what neoliberalism really is doing here, what it is, and why women's rights are actually used and exploited by these neoliberals. Just to give you an example, this is a complicated discussion, and again, I'm happy to go back to this during the Q&A, but one example is Sirma Bilge, who is a great Canadian feminist who has worked especially on issues of intersectionality, and she has analyzed the phenomenon of sexual nationalism in Quebec, because also this alliance, kind of alliance between some feminists and nationalists against Islam is also quite strong in Quebec. There has been a huge discussion. So according to Sirma Bilge, it is possible for neoliberals and nationalists to claim they are now defending women's rights and also gay rights, because she says neoliberalism tends, is an ideological formation, we can say, that tends to obscure material problems and structural realities. So neoliberals don't really want to talk about inequalities, they don't want to talk about class, they want really to talk about culture and cultural wars. That's why she thinks that neoliberalism, because of these tendency to avoid discussions about inequalities, is a fertile terrain to talk about instead problems between cultures, differences between cultures, or in fact the clash of civilizations, which was obviously, if you want, one of the biggest we can say claims really inaugurating in some ways neoliberalism. My feeling though is that these studies tended to treat neoliberalism as the economic theater of operation for the encounter between these different array of forces, but not as one of the main characters on stage. We don't really understand how neoliberalism is operating here, in my view. So while I agree that neoliberalism is central for understanding these phenomena, I argue that neoliberalism is not simply the contextual ground on which the femo-nationalist convergence takes place, but it is itself constitutive of such a convergence. And the rest of the paper really is devoted to explain what exactly I mean by this. So again, the chief example here are what I already mentioned briefly, the civic integration programs. Now, I already explained a little bit how they work. I think you might be familiar with these programs also, as I said, in Germany, because you have something like this also in this country. So what I think is interesting, what is particularly interesting for me about the civic integration programs, as I will try to make it clearer, is that they are a powerful reminder that femo-nationalism is not just some kind of flea-floating discourse. So it's not just confined to the media. So it's not just, you know, for example, Alice Schwarzer every now and again saying, oh, Muslim men are patriarchal, we need to get rid of them. Or someone like Matteo Salvini in Italy saying, well, of course, we want to rescue and help Muslim women to emancipate, but then there are no consequences, perhaps. There are lots of consequences out of these discourses. This is what I really want to get to. So the civic integration programs are an example. This is not just rhetoric. This is not just political propaganda and rhetoric. This is actually, femo-nationalism is increasingly institutionalized. And one of the ways in which it is institutionalized is precisely through these civic integration programs. Now, the majority of studies, again, on civic integration programs have focused upon the cultural dimensions of civic integration programs. So I gave you a little example earlier saying, if you look at the materials that are used in these integration programs, they all focus upon, for example, in France, they tell migrants, our French culture, our history is proud of women's rights. And they do this, for instance, by producing little documentaries or videos in which they show, the woman like Ségolène Royal entering the parliament, or the woman becoming a bus driver. So they show that their way of saying our culture is pride of women's rights is by showing how now women in Europe also do traditionally males' jobs. This is just to give you an example. There are more extreme and in some ways funny cases, like in the Netherlands, where they produced a video in which they showed women topless, and it was a kind of provocation, especially according to them, to Muslim migrants, because it was for them a way of saying, oh, look, in the Netherlands, we are so open and we are so emancipated that our women go topless on the beach, and so you really need to get used to that. So this is just to say there have been lots of studies focusing on this, and it's very important, obviously. What has been investigated much less is that the civic integration programs are not just about culture. It's not just about, you know, talking about women's rights, etc., and showing images. It's very much also about economy. And the way in which this works is that since 2007, at the European level, they have established the so-called European Integration Fund, which is designed specifically to fund initiatives in various European countries that help migrants to integrate. So the way it works is that, you know, if you have an organization, it can be a women's organization or a migrants organization or any organization really, in a way, and if you have an idea about how you can help migrants in your city, for example, to better integrate, you can apply for these funds. And if you're successful, the European Union will give you money to carry out your project. Now, if you look at, what I did, I spent my days when I was writing this book really looking at what they are funding in these countries, in these three countries, after 2007, between 2007 and 2013. And I was especially interested in seeing what they were funding in terms of initiatives aimed at women's integration. Because one of the main aims of these integration funds is to actually help women to integrate. They say very explicitly, women and disabled people, etc., some categories in particular, who are in special need of integration should be given priorities within these programs. So I looked specifically at those programs that had been funded to help the integration of women. And what I found that was quite interesting was that, first of all, the idea that Muslim women and migrant women need to integrate is based very much according to the assumption that these women really tend to work less than non-migrant or non-Muslim women. So the idea is, which is also, in a way it is true, if you look at the statistics, Muslim women and often migrant women seem to have a lower so-called activity rate compared to non-migrant women. Now, these statistics can be also very deceptive because lots of women, especially migrant women, for reasons that I will explain, sometimes do not appear in the statistics as workers because they tend to also be employed in the black market without regular contracts and so forth. But apart from that, it is also true that many of these women find hard to find jobs. What is interesting, though, is that when you look at the reasons these programs give for the difficulties these women find in finding a job, they tend to say, implicitly or explicitly, oh, they don't find jobs because they come from cultures in which their husbands or their male relatives don't want them to work. So these are cultures in which women are supposed to stay home and take care of the children or take care of the husband. When you look at the reality, actually, and there have been studies on this, these women tell you that they actually find it hard to find jobs very often because they face discrimination in the labor market. because very often they go to try to find a job and no one wants to hire them. Sometimes this is related to having a headscarf. So if they are Muslim women, wearing a headscarf is increasingly difficult for women in some countries to find a job. But this is something that these studies don't tell you. They don't talk so much about discrimination, but they tend to say, oh, this is really because maybe they don't really want to work, or maybe because their men prevent them from working. So what was it? So this is just the premise of these economic integration programs. So when I looked, I said, okay, so let's see what these programs are doing to help these migrant women to integrate, because obviously it is great to help, to have initiatives that also help migrant women to integrate and to find a job and so forth. But when you look at these programs, what I found is that in France, in Italy, and in the Netherlands, in very similar ways, the majority of initiatives related to migrant women's employment tend to actually track them, to channel them towards a very few types of jobs. So usually they tend to be employed and channeled towards jobs as nannies, babysitters, hotel cleaners, toilet cleaners, and so forth. So all those jobs in the so-called socially reproductive economy. Now, I thought when I actually found this, that this was quite problematic. And I just want to give you a little example of this. This is from Italy. And this, for example, is taken from a booklet that was published just a few years ago by an association called Nosotras, which means us, we, in Spanish. And actually, this is a very good organization. It was founded in the late 1990s, if I recall correctly, by a mixed group of Italian women and migrant women. And this organization had very good intentions, precisely to help migrant women in their integration journey in Italy, address the problems of migrant women, and so forth. So this organization has become bigger and bigger in Italy, and now it covers several cities in the Emilia-Romagna area. And so they were one of the recipients of these integration funds I was talking about. And they were given money by the European Union to help migrant women to find jobs. So this booklet explains what they did, how they did this. So the way they did was basically to have a number of women, many of them migrants. This woman you see here, for example, I'm sorry, I can't remember now her name, but she's from Ghana, it says. Sorry, she's Ghani, I'm sorry. And she is, she works for the organization, and she is one of the women helping other migrant women to integrate. And she says in this account, yes, what I do to help them to integrate is I go with them to job interviews. And usually, she says, the majority of these job interviews are for elderly care, cleaning and so forth. So again, because sometimes there are no statistics about this, what is quite interesting is that the majority of jobs, in fact, are for these women are in this type of sector. Now, so all in all, my argument here is that all in all, the encouragement of migrant women to be active in the labor market and the identification of mechanisms like these civic integration and economic integration programs to help them to integrate have de facto directed them towards those jobs that many European non-migrant women do not want to do anymore. So as we know, again, from statistics and studies, the reason why all these women are, the migrant women are directed towards these jobs is because many European women are in fact trying to work in other sectors, quite understandably. So this really led me to think that there is at least a huge contradiction when feminists and femocrats urge emancipation for Muslim and non-Western migrant women while channeling them towards the very sphere from which the feminist movement had historically tried to liberate women. So this is not merely a rhetorical contradiction, but it is concretely performed in action. By which I mean that I think it's quite problematic, and it's something I'd like to discuss also with you, how is that these organizations with best intentions, I'm not denying that, how is that in the name of emancipation, they are actually pushing these women to take jobs in those spheres of labor that are very exploited, paid very, very poorly, in which women work for many hours, very often without days off, without benefits, pensions, and so forth. All of these in the name of emancipating them. And what is even, in a way, worse is that these are exactly those jobs these same feminists and femocrats do not want to do. So they're asking these women to do them whilst telling them, this is going to help you, this is going to rescue and to, you know, help you to be economically independent. Now, I think here is also important to mention, though, the active role of right-wing parties, because it's not just, as you can imagine, these neoliberals who want these women, migrant women, to work more, because obviously all of this is linked to workfare programs, and it's not just these feminists who are carrying out, obviously, these integration programs, but also, quite interestingly, also these right-wing parties, actually they are willing to close an eye when it comes to migrant women doing these jobs. And I just want to give you a little example here as well. This is from, again, the Northern League, when it was still Lega Padana, so this is just from a few years ago. What's interesting is not so much the image, which says, enough is enough, get out of this country, referring to this mass of Muslim men, as you can tell from the picture. But what's interesting is that in 2009, there was a regularization. It was the Berlusconi government still, and there was a regularization of migrants. And on that occasion, because you might remember, we were in the midst of the economic crisis. So the Berlusconi government had decided that Italy could not host any more migrants, because the idea was, we are in the midst of an economic crisis, so all jobs available need to be given to Italian people. Something that I'm sure is very familiar as a rhetoric, because we have it in all countries in Europe. But what's interesting is that on that occasion, Roberto Maroni, who was the leader then of the Northern League, said, and I just quote from here, there cannot be a regularization for those who entered illegally, for those who rape a woman or rob a villa, but certainly we will take into account all those situations that have a strong social impact, as in the case of migrant caregivers. So what they did was, okay, we're not going to regularize migrants, but we are going to make an exception for migrant women working as elderly carers. Because, well, there is the need for these women. Our women don't really want to do it anymore, so someone must do it. So why don't we let these women do it? So again, talking about emancipation and rescuing of women, of Muslim and migrant women. Now, we need to, the economic crisis actually is very important for the framework of my argument here, because what I am trying to say here is that the reason why these right-wing parties are willing to close an eye on migrant women and Muslim women, and even to say we want to emancipate them and we want to rescue them, is because at the moment in Europe there is a huge demand for elderly care and child care. And the reason is that there is a huge, the European population is aging. We have more and more elderly people, but there are not enough carers and there are not enough welfare facilities for these people, because neoliberal welfare states are being increasingly cut. So what's happening is that these countries are relying more and more on the cheap labor of migrant women. And again, I'm not going into detail, I'm sorry, it's very dark, but this is just a table from the OECD in which it shows to you that during the crisis, while the job, actually this table shows you the jobs that have been lost only, sorry, the economic performance only of migrant workers. So these are only numbers about migrant workers, okay? And when you look into that, if you can look a little bit, you can see that construction, manufacture of various types, they all have a negative sign, which means that in those economic sectors, migrants have lost jobs, okay? When you look at the bottom of the table, you see instead that residential care activities, activities of households as employers of domestic personnel, education and human health, so all jobs in so-called social reproduction, the sector I described, they all have a positive sign, which means that jobs in those sectors actually have not been lost, precisely because, as I said, there is a huge demand for this labor at the moment. The care industry or the social reproductive sector of elderly care, childcare, cleaning has been the only one in Europe to be spared from the crisis, in the sense that demand for this work has not diminished. And the reason is quite obvious. If you have an elderly person, and there are more and more, and if you have children, you need someone to care for them. And obviously, even in times of crisis, very often families are willing to keep paying someone to do that if they have no alternatives. And states have intervened into this problem of demand, etc., in different ways. So I'm really going to my conclusion. So what I want to really to stress here is that the care sector, this sector that, as I'm showing you, is not being affected so much by the economic crisis, is the sector to which really the classic crisis management operations of capitalism do not apply. And the reason is that you can shut down manufacture and you can relocate it to China or to Indonesia, as many countries have done in Europe. You can shut down construction, you simply stop building houses for a while, but you cannot shut down social reproduction because someone must still care for elderly and for children and for people. So-called life-making activities need to be carried out. So there is no possibility for capitalism in this sense to use the usual tricks of relocation and shutdown in the case of social reproduction. And so, as I said, the care work must continue even in periods of recession in order to guarantee the daily functioning of our societies. And in the present context of Western European women's growing rates of employment, it is increasingly Muslim and non-Western migrant women who are providing care for the children, the disabled, and the elderly. This is occurring precisely at the historical moment in which Western Europe is both privatizing welfare and care services and confronted with an even ever larger aging population. In other words, it is not by chance that civic integration programs encourage Muslim and non-Western migrant women to find jobs in the care and domestic sector or social reproduction. This is, in fact, a sector for which the demand is on the rise, particularly in a situation in which the population is aging fast, but European women do not want to work as carers. So the emphasis on non-Western migrant women overall as individuals to be helped in their integration and emancipation process, including through job offers, is thus possible because they, unlike male migrant workers, currently occupy a strategic role in the social reproductive sector of childcare, elderly care, and cleaning. Rather than job stealers, as you know, many migrant workers are called job stealers, those who are taking jobs away from natives. Muslim migrant women are not called this way. So rather than job stealers, Muslim and non-Western migrant women are instead presented as those who allow Western European men and women to work in the public sphere by providing the care that neoliberal restructuring has commodified. So my really last slide in conclusion, I want to suggest that the double standard applied to Muslim and non-Western migrant women in the public imaginary as individuals in need of special attention and even rescue operates as an ideological tool that is strictly connected to their key role, present or future, in the reproduction of the material conditions of social reproduction. Femonationalism should be understood as part and parcel of the specifically neoliberal reorganization of welfare, labor, and state immigration policies that have occurred in the context of the global financial crisis, and more generally, the Western European crisis of social reproduction. Thank you very much.